For the Christian, this world is an arena, not an armchair. For the Christian, John Blanchard writes, this world is an arena, not an armchair. He makes his point quite effectively, I think. The very context into which God has placed Christianity, the world, necessitates the engagement of a gladiator, not the passivity of a spectator. For the Christian, this world is an arena, not an armchair. Warren Wiersbe has said it more directly. For the Christian, life is not a playground, it is a battlefield. J. Gresham Machen added, it is impossible to be a true soldier of Jesus Christ and not fight. Why is this so? It's because as Christians in this world, we live in a context that includes an enemy whose evil ambition is our death and destruction. It's because we have an enemy, beloved, that is real and vicious and violent, an enemy full of hate, an enemy with no capacity to love, an enemy driven by nothing but his own selfish ambition, an enemy who seeks to use you and discard you. Throughout the Bible, he's known by various names. The evil one, the ancient serpent, the god of this world, the prince of the demons, the murderer, the tempter, the liar, the father of lies, the accuser of the brethren, Belial, Beelzebub, Apollyon, Abaddon, the adversary, the enemy, the great red dragon, the devil, and of course, Satan. You say, now, let me see if I can get the drift of what you're saying. You actually believe in a real, personal devil? I'm not left with much choice, friends. Seven of our Old Testament books speak of his existence. So does every New Testament writer. Jesus himself refers to Satan some 25 times, often in direct conversation. How then could I deny the existence of a real, personal devil? He is driven by two great passions, his hatred of God and his hostility toward the human race. And as such, he engages relentlessly in various expressions of evil and destruction. For example, he wages warfare against the Christian, Ephesians 6. He undermines confidence in the Word of God, Genesis 3. He blinds the minds of people to the gospel message, 2 Corinthians 4. He hinders Christian ministry, 1 Thessalonians 2. He breeds discouragement, 1 Peter 5. He infiltrates the church with erroneous doctrine, 1 John 4. He promotes division in the congregation, 2 Corinthians 2. He is described on the one hand as bearing the ferocity of a roaring lion, while on the other hand bearing the attractiveness of an angel of light, which means he can skillfully adapt himself and his tactics to each situation and individual person. One of the old Puritans said it like this: the devil shapes himself to the fashions of all men. If he meet with a proud man or a prodigal man, then he makes himself a flatterer. If a covetous man, then he comes with a reward in his hand. He has an apple for Eve, a grape for Noah, a change of raiment for Gehazi, a bag for Judas. He can dish out his meat for all palates. He has a last to fit every shoe. He has something to please all conditions. Over the last 2.5 years, we've become better informed as to who this devil is, given the fact that he's mentioned more often in the Revelation than in any other book of the Bible. In chapters 2 and 3, if you recall, he is seen to be the source standing behind both the Jewish and Roman persecution of Christians. He is the one who inspires idolatry and false teaching among the churches. In chapter 9, he is referred to as the angel of the bottomless pit. In chapter 12, portrayed as the great red dragon, seeking to thwart God's redemptive program by killing the messianic child. Upon his defeat, he turns all of his vehemence then against the messianic community, the church. And how does he do that? By calling forth two various incarnations. Chapter 13, the power of state persecution as embodied in the beast, the power of religious and philosophical deception embodied in the false prophet. Together, they work ceaselessly, inspired by Satan, to eradicate the influence of Christianity from the face of the earth. He hates God. He hates God's people. He hates you. He seeks your destruction. And that is true, my friends, even to this very hour. For still our ancient foe doth seek to work us woe. His craft and power are great, and armed with cruel hate, on earth is not his equal. And yet, beloved, what else have we learned from the revelation? That for all of his wickedness, Satan is not an equal with God. The dark and evil counterpart to God, not even in the truest sense, a corresponding rival of God. He is a creature who bears all the limitations of creaturehood, which means, most importantly, like every other created thing, his very existence is altogether dependent upon God's sovereign purpose and pleasure. Satan, beloved, does not exist autonomously of God. He exists, I would remind you, because of God. And if you think about it, friends, this, like nothing else, reveals the corrupting influence of sin. Do you realize that the consuming ambition of Satan is built upon a contradiction he's too sinful to do anything about? You say, well, what do you mean? Every time he seeks to destroy God, he attempts to saw off the very branch he's sitting on. A creature revolting against his creator is a revolt against the source of his own powers, including even his power to revolt. Satan is not God's evil peer. He is not independent of God. As a creature, he is dependent upon God for his very life. And also, we must never forget, like every other creature, he is accountable to God for all the evil he does, subject to the judgment of God, which in his case unfolds in three phases. Beloved, our victory over Satan begins by understanding that his eternal judgment was announced way back in chapter 3 of Genesis in the Garden of Eden. Do you recall it? Though he would strike the heel of the woman's seed, that very act of doing so would result in his own head being subsequently crushed. The first phase of Satan's eternal judgment was the announcement of it in the Garden of Eden. The second phase of that judgment was inaugurated in the redemptive mission of Jesus Christ. What did we discover in chapter 12? As in various other passages throughout the New Testament scriptures, Satan has been forever conquered by means of the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. That is the definitive act. Already, if you recall, he has been thrown out of heaven as a defeated foe, raging with anger for the very reason he knows his days are numbered. Scheming then, conniving, manipulating to bring down with himself as many as he possibly can. But we give praise to God this morning because what was announced in the garden and inaugurated at the cross is now brought to full consummation in the scene set before us. The third and final phase of Satan's eternal judgment. I don't know if you've ever realized this, beloved, but on the pages of the inspired scriptures, it is this text in Revelation 20 that marks the final mention of the devil. We are never to hear of him again. Ever. It is the record of his inescapable doom, his eternal confinement to a place that, according to Jesus, has been specifically prepared for him by God. Matthew 25:41, the lake of fire. Now, the scene itself is very brief. Very little detail. For our purposes this morning, it can be easily understood if we consider it under three simple headings. Firstly, Satan's temporary freedom. Secondly, Satan's eternal demise. And third, I'll save it for the conclusion. Okay? Now, to begin with, let's take note of what John here records. That is Satan's temporary freedom. Verse 7. When the 1,000 years are ended, Satan will be released from his prison and will come out to deceive the nations at the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, in order to gather them for battle. But this is no innocuous battle, one battle among many battles. The original text actually reads like this: in order to gather them for the battle. The battle. It's called an article of previous reference in that it's intended to bring to our minds something that John has already mentioned. In other words, beloved, what John is saying to us is this: the time has now arrived for the battle that I've been telling you about. The battle. The battle of Armageddon that I mentioned to you back in chapter 16. The battle when the beasts and the kings of the earth gathered to destroy the Lamb in chapter 17. And most recently, the battle at the end of chapter 19, when the beast and all the unbelieving peoples of the earth gather to make war against the rider on the white horse. This here, now, is the final and ultimate reference to all of those previously mentioned battles. It is the battle. In fact, if you remember, friends, we took some pains to note that the battle in chapter 19 was described in terms that reveal it to be the fulfillment of the great last day's battle prophesied in Ezekiel 38 and 39. Now here, beginning in chapter 20, verse 7, John cites the very same Old Testament passage again because this is the very same battle, the last battle. In take 1, chapter 19, verses 17 to 21, the focus of the camera records the defeat in particular of the beast and the false prophet. In take 2 now, chapter 20, verses 7 to 10, the camera specifically zooms in to capture the defeat of the devil. So that the same battle is recycled to give us two different looks at it, a pattern that copies the very literary design originally employed by Ezekiel himself. The text that John borrows here. In Ezekiel chapter 38, we have a portrayal of a great battle in which the enemies of God gathered to destroy his people. In chapter 9, the very same battle is recapitulated with our attention drawn to some different emphases. What's the outcome of the battle? By means of fire, burning sulfur, a brandished sword, the very same implements employed here in this text, God wins. All by himself. And then what happens? In the very next chapter, Ezekiel 40, he begins to set forth a portrait of the new age. In what kind of terms? In apocalyptic terms. A rebuilt temple in the new Jerusalem. And beloved, that's precisely now what this is. Two looks at the last battle with the final victory achieved by God himself, followed by a portrait of the new and eternal age cast in the terms of a new Jerusalem. Now that's the broad context. Let's take a more narrow look. When the 1,000 years are ended, but what's this 1,000 years? Not a literal period of 365,000 24-hour days. Rather, as we have already established, the complete period of time that exists between the two comings of Jesus Christ, however long that may be. And here, friends, one of the little clues that hint at this is the word my translation renders, when. When the 1,000 years are ended. But the nuance of that little word, you see, the word hotan, is intended to communicate something much more indefinite and nebulous. So that it actually is better translated, whenever. Whenever the 1,000 years are ended, subtly suggesting, you see, that this extended period of time is uncertain, and therefore by implication, not to be understood as a literal 1,000 years. If it's a literal 1,000 years, you don't use the word whenever. Whenever the 1,000 years are ended, Satan will be released from his prison. Now, up in verse 3, we learn that for this millennial period, Satan would be bound to the bottomless pit, the abyss. Now, here, John refers to it as a prison. Why? To highlight the fact that in some significant sense, Satan is confined, restrained. But restrained from doing what? Restrained from all his nefarious activities? No, verse 3 was very clear for us. This confinement of Satan for the millennium consists in his inability to deceive the nations. At the conclusion of this period, however, whenever it arrives at that appointed moment, suddenly, the shackles will fall from Satan's wrists. The door to his jail cell will slide open, and he will walk in apparent freedom. But why, you ask? Was he found to be innocent after all? Did someone post his bail? You've seen the old westerns, friends. He's being set free for the final gunfight, for the final showdown. And of course, the first thing he does is assembles his old gang. Notice that John mentions the immediate purpose for his release and then the ultimate purpose for it. Whenever the 1,000 years are ended, Satan will be released from his prison. Why? He will come out to deceive the nations. That's the immediate purpose for this release. Notice now the ultimate purpose. In order to gather them for the battle. And by the way, take a look at this carefully. Did you notice the global scope of Satan's gang? Its worldwide proportions? In take one of this last battle, you may remember that this universality of this army was illustrated rather graphically. Remember, verse 17 of chapter 19? Come gather for the great supper of God to eat the flesh of kings, the flesh of captains, the flesh of the mighty, the flesh of horses and their riders, flesh of all, both free and slave, both small and great. This army that is mounted against Jesus Christ is a universal army. Here in take two now, the worldwide scope of Satan's army is expressed in three ways: geographically, literarily, and numerically. To begin with, notice this army is comprised of people who are assembled from the four corners of the earth. Now, beloved, it's not a scientific statement about the shape of our planet. It's a geographical literary device to refer to the whole world. The four corners of the earth. Satan's deception, for the purpose of establishing an unprecedented military force, will be at this point global in its extent. Secondly, note, John illustrates this literarily in that he refers to this army as Gog and Magog. Language taken from Ezekiel 38 and 39, referring to the last day's army that will seek to destroy God's people. Now, what's interesting for you to realize is that in a great many Jewish writings, subsequent to the writing of Ezekiel, including the Talmud itself, Gog and Magog came to be used as a standard literary reference for all the nations of the earth in rebellion against God. Now, I need to tell you this because as a young Christian, I was taught that Gog and Magog was a reference to Russia. Did you hear that, some of you? The Soviet Union, after all, Gog is called the chief prince of Magog, and chief in Hebrew is the word Rosh, and Rosh sounds an awful lot like Russia to me. And one of the cities over which he rules is called Meshech, which sounds an awful lot like Moscow to me. Which is one of the reasons why during the time of the 70s and early 80s, with the popularity of this kind of thinking, many American evangelicals sought to promote political agendas that stockpiled our armaments because we may go to nuclear war with the Soviet Union. But beloved, this army is not comprised of one group of people. The context is clear. This Gog and Magog are gathered from the four corners of the earth. This army, in other words, is a universal conglomeration. Thirdly, John illustrates this numerically when he says, they are as numerous as the sands of the sea. Now that, beloved, is a specific scene taken from two Old Testament battle phrases. A phrase taken from two, I said that wrong. A specific phrase taken from two Old Testament battle scenes. Joshua and God's people drawing up in battle against the Canaanites. Gideon and God's people lining up to do battle with the Midianites. In both cases, the enemy was likened to sand on a seashore, the sand of the sea. Implying what? Implying that because of their vastly superior numbers, the odds of victory was overwhelmingly in favor of the enemies of God's people. This army that Satan will assemble at the conclusion of the millennium will be worldwide in scope, beloved. It's like nothing we've ever conceived of. Nothing we could ever imagine. Nothing we've ever seen. Universal cooperation in one great military power under the direct influence of the devil himself. You say, but Art, how could such a thing ever happen? I can't tell you the specifics, beloved, because the text doesn't say. What it does tell us, however, is that this army is assembled for battle by means of the deceptive powers of Satan. They are assembled as a consequence of his deceptive schemes, his lies. Satan, after all, has now been unfettered, released, free to deceive the nations. And it really isn't beyond the possibility of our thinking, friends, given the fact that we have actual illustrations from our own recent history that at least imply that such a thing could happen, don't we? Think of Nazism. It wasn't that long ago. Coming to power in one of the leading cultural countries in all of the world. The country, I would remind you, in which the Protestant Reformation was launched. And yet a country that recoiled from its Christian heritage and opted for a godless opposite. And what about the emergence of communism in the Soviet Union? For centuries, don't forget, huh? We're so distanced. But for centuries, the Orthodox Church had been leavening that culture with Christianity. The revolution, however, rejected it, sought to reinvent their civilization on the grounds of atheism. Now, of course, as you well know, neither of these godless states has endured. But because of them, it's not that difficult to visualize a godless rejection of the gospel on a worldwide scale. The uniting of anti-Christian powers of the entire world under the leadership of Satan himself, who has been released so as to exercise the fullness of his deceptive influence. We do not as yet, on our worst day, know what that's like. Why does he do this? How was it expressed back in take 1? Verse 19 of chapter 19. Then I saw the beast and the kings of the earth with their armies gathered to make the war against the rider on the horse and against his army. Satan and his global military assembled to destroy Jesus Christ and his people once and for all. Now look at it, beloved, from a different camera angle. Take 2. He will come out to deceive the nations at the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, in order to gather them for battle. They are as numerous as the sands of the sea. Now watch. They marched up over the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints in the beloved city. Now, friends, I would remind you, lest you get beguiled by the way we customarily read things. We're dealing here with apocalyptic. Which means that we're not to envision this in geographical categories as though somehow all of the people of God managed to gather in one specific place and suddenly they find themselves surrounded by every other person on the earth. The two phrases used by John here, the camp of the saints and the beloved city, are symbolic references to the people of God, the church. I mean, beloved, let's begin with what's most obvious. Part of this we should get by now. In the Revelation, we're given to see two great cities. What's the subtitle for the book of Revelation? A Tale of Two Cities. Babylon the Harlot, the New Jerusalem, both of which refer to communities of human beings. Babylon, as we learned, was not a reference to a literal city on the Tigris and Euphrates River. It was a way of speaking about the human race as a community in rebellion against God. The New Jerusalem, as we discovered, is also a community of people, human beings, willingly under the dominion of God. So that when John now speaks of the beloved city being surrounded, we're not to think of a literal city like Jerusalem. We let John interpret himself. And in the very next chapter, he tells us what the beloved city is, the bride, the wife of the Lamb. The beloved city here, friends, is a reference to the people of God, the New Jerusalem inaugurated, but not yet consummated. You say, well, okay, but why are we likened to a camp? Friends, throughout all of Revelation, what one Old Testament event has been drawn upon again and again and again to illustrate various aspects of the life and experience of the Church of Jesus Christ? The Exodus. So let me ask you something. For 40 years prior to their entrance into the Promised Land, how did those people live? In two-story single-family units? In condominiums? Apartment complexes? They lived in a camp, positioned in such a way that their tents surrounded God's tent, the tabernacle. Now, to live in that camp, because God's presence was there, those people had to be made ritually clean. But if something were to defile them, for example, someone in their family was to die and they were required to take care of that dead body, they were forced to live outside of the camp until proper purification for them had been made. That's the underpinning imagery here, now applied to the church. Israel fulfilled. We are the camp of the saints. In the Old Testament, saints had reference to the people of Israel. We come to the New Testament, now also refer to Israel as expressed in Jew and Gentile. We're the camp of the saints. Why the camp of the saints? Because as yet, beloved, we're still pilgrims. We are wilderness wanderers who have not yet entered into the promised land. At the same time, because the blood of Jesus Christ has secured our eternal purification, we're people who live securely in God's presence. We're the camp of the saints. We're the beloved city. Now, the point here is simply this. At the conclusion of this millennial period, Satan will be released from his prison for the purpose of assembling a worldwide army of unbelievers. Why a worldwide army? Think about what's going on here. Why a worldwide army? To destroy every last vestige of the Church of Jesus Christ as she is scattered throughout all of the earth. This is a rebellion of this fallen world order to extricate from this planet every remnant of Christianity. Now, beloved, this is what Satan does with his temporary freedom. He does what he has always wanted to do, but up until this point in time has been bound from doing. It's why it's not happened yet, you see. He deceives the world into following him to the last battle that he might forever destroy Jesus Christ and his people. And admittedly, beloved, for the church, the outcome appears bleak. Because just as it was in the days of Joshua and Gideon, the enemy we face seems overwhelming. It's universal. It's innumerable. But what happened in the days of Joshua and Gideon? God fought for his people. To what end? His enemies were resoundingly defeated, and his people emerged gloriously victorious. The very thing that now happens here. Notice, in the simplest and briefest words, that Satan's temporary freedom is followed by Satan's eternal demise. And fire came down from heaven and consumed them. Did you notice here the height of this destruction? To be sure, this destruction appears suddenly and unexpectedly, like an instantaneous blast of lightning. And one can recognize here certain historical antecedents, right? If you know your Bible, we're reminded of the scene of Sodom and Gomorrah, for example, with the fire and brimstone. The ministry of Elijah with fire devouring his enemies. In each of these cases of judgment, however, including this very one before us, one fact is undeniably plain to see. And that is that the outpouring of that judgment originated in heaven. The source of it is none other than God Himself. It came down out of heaven. Did you notice the objects of this destruction? You say, well, this judgment falls on Satan. No, it doesn't. Satan's judgment comes in verse 10. What does this verse say? And fire came down from heaven and consumed them. So who are the them? Look at the next verse. And the devil who had deceived, here it is again, them. Who had the devil deceived? All those, in verses 7 and 8, who joined the worldwide army of Satan with a view to destroying the Church of Jesus Christ. In other words, the recipients of this judgment are human beings. Finally, did you notice the thoroughness of this judgment, this destruction? And fire came down from heaven and consumed them. It means to eat up completely. To devour so that not one thing remains. This judgment falls out of heaven And when it is finished, my friends, there is not the slightest shred of remaining evidence to indicate the prior presence of even one rebellious human being. Now, is that all that is left to be said about sinful human beings? No, my friends, as we will see next Lord's Day, this is not their final judgment. This is just the means of transportation to get them to the final judgment. And what about the devil? Verse 10. And the devil who had deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and sulfur, where the beast and the false prophet were. Do you remember this from take one? Verse 19? Verse 20 of chapter 19? And the beast was captured, and with it the false prophet who had performed in its presence the signs by which he had deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped its image. These two were thrown alive into the lake of fire that burns with sulfur. Now, beloved, in take two, the camera specifically focuses on the devil. And together, the three of them, the devil, the beast, the false prophet, this unholy trinity, they are united in judgment, and they will be tormented. Notice, friends, notice this is so very important for what we will see next week. Notice they are not uncreated. They are not annihilated. They are not bereft of existence and life. Poof, gone. Rather, they endure an unspeakable torment. Notice, that includes no intermission, day and night, and no conclusion, forever and ever. By the way, friends, where's the last battle? Did you catch the last battle? Wasn't all of this about the last battle? I thought the title of the sermon is The Last Battle. Where's the last battle? There is no battle. Not anywhere to be found. You didn't miss it. It's not there. Why? Because there can be no battle when the one opposed is the God of overwhelming power. When God finally wills to destroy evil, there will be no battle. No engagement, no resistance, not even the slightest skirmish. Like a tiny anthill in the path of a devastating tornado will his enemy stand before him. The last battle? There will be no battle. Only the unimpeded manifestation of his irresistible omnipotence. Satan's temporary freedom results in Satan's eternal demise. This ought to make you very happy. Do you realize what this will mean for you, my Christian friend? Have you ever thought about this? Your experience of salvation in Jesus Christ anticipates an eternity that is devil-free. An eternity in which every single moment of your blissful existence will be free of the devil's schemes, lies, deceptions, attacks, persecutions, pains, temptations. He will not be there to beguile you, to torment you, or to kill you. You will know a kind of life then, beloved, that you can't even begin to imagine right now, because the fact is every moment of your life in this world is marred by the fingerprints of the devil. On that day, boys and girls, on that day, you'll never again fear the dark. Because the one who seeks your harm will have been sent to hell forever. Satan's temporary freedom will result in Satan's eternal demise. Which reminds me, beloved, of one final point. Satan's unwavering obedience. You say, would you say that again? Satan's unwavering obedience? What do you mean Satan's unwavering obedience? Everything Satan ever does is evil. Right. Every inclination of his wicked heart and mind is evil. Right. At the same time, every single thing he ever does perfectly serves God's eternal purpose. I mean, beloved, did you notice what was so very telling in verse 7? Did you notice? It ought to scream out to you. Did you see it there? Satan doesn't escape from the abyss. He doesn't overpower the angelic jailer who confined him to that place. He didn't outsmart him at the conclusion of the millennium. He's released. He's set free. Certainly this must be an accident of some kind. An administrative oversight, perhaps. No. 2 weeks ago, I intentionally avoided any comment on the very last line of verse 3. Let me set it up in its context. And now feel its weightiness. He seized the dragon, that ancient serpent, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years, and threw him into the pit and locked and sealed it over him so that he would deceive the nations no more until 1,000 years were ended. After that, he must be let out for a little while. Do you hear it? Do you feel it? You need to circle that little word, must. It speaks of divine determination. It speaks, beloved, of God's foreordained purpose. Now, do you realize what this means? It means that all we have seen here is not simply a mere record of what will take place in the future. It is an unveiling of the purpose of God that He had ordained in eternity past. Satan does not frustrate God by escaping from this prison to work his havoc in the world. He's set free by God because God has a predetermined purpose for Satan to serve. A purpose that Satan himself simultaneously desires in the wickedness of his own heart. What's Satan's agenda? To deceive the nations. Why? To amass a worldwide army. Why? To destroy the Church of Jesus Christ. Why? Because God had predetermined that this is where he would meet Satan in final judgment. Because way back in the Garden of Eden, God had promised that the head of the serpent would be crushed by the seed of the woman once and for all. He must be released. Because this is where God will keep his promise. What was accomplished by Jesus at the cross is here enacted in the fullness of its consequences and implications. My friends, if you don't take anything else away from our 2.5 years in the Revelation, I will die a happy pastor if I know that you will never again fall prey to the trap of dualism. The idea that God and Satan are competitors of equal stature, fighting it out for supremacy in the universe. Satan is a creature who must, always, and does serve the eternal purpose of God. Never again give him more credit than he deserves. Never again think that he even draws another breath apart from the ordination of God. In all of his wickedness, Satan gives God unwavering obedience. He is God, Satan, don't forget, for all of his evil. He always brings God's glory, always bring God's glory, and he always obeys God. Always, 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 for all of his hatred and evil, he always obeys God. Which means, beloved, today that you will break my heart if you leave saying, we heard a message about Satan today. This is not a message about Satan. As always, it's a message about God. Satan, like every other created thing, is just another means of glorifying him. Satan is just a foil to reveal how great our God is. As for you this morning, you do not want to be a part of the people aligned with Satan. And if you're not a Christian, you are. You do not want to be aligned with him. And why not? Well, it's as the hymn writer says. His rage we can endure, for lo, his doom is sure. You must seek to belong to the camp of the saints, the beloved city. For such people, God fights and God prevails. And for such people, it means an eternity. Never, ever again to be interrupted by the presence of the devil. Praise be to God for that. Would you take a moment and bow your heads with me, please?